Morning. Is that on, Brad? Maybe. Yeah? Okay. If you had to pick one word in any language, and I know that most of us are pretty limited in that capacity, English, Spanish, is there some sort of fictional Elvish for some of you who are very well-versed in the Lord of the Rings? Is there some word that you can think of, one word that you hate more than all other words? What would that be if you had to pick one? Maybe you've not thought about this question as it seems a little stupid, and it might be, but I don't mind telling you that I have thought about it a great deal over the years. When you, as you grow up and as your vocabulary expands and you find more precise words for the things that you're thinking and learn how to describe things in more colorful language, you come across words that sort of encapsulate ideas that you really dislike. And I'm not talking about the words themselves, like how they're constructed or how people say them. Like, I know we all hate the way the British say, like, issue and words like that. And maybe not even, like, fictional words like irregardless, things that are just made up but people continue to use for whatever reason. When I typed that Microsoft Word, like, closed the program and blew up. But I'm rather talking about a word that you hate because of its meaning, its connotation, its baggage. You just can't stand it because of all that it stands for and encapsulates. For some of you, the word might be a person's name. Perhaps there's somebody out there who's had a negative impact on a huge swath of your life. And for others, it might be a particular worldview, like Islam or naturalism. Maybe the word for you is something like sin or Satan or self. If you've never gone through the exercise of thinking about it before, I would encourage you to do it. The same principle in Jesus' maxim of wherever your treasure is, there your heart will be also, in Matthew 6:21, is at play in settling on whatever it is that we despise and loathe the most in this world. Personally, the word that keeps me up at night is boredom. Bored, boring, bore, whatever its manifestation, and you could probably use it to describe the way that I talk, I hate it with every fiber of my being. I hate reading it, I hate hearing it, and I hate all that it stands for. For a Christian to profess that he or she is bored is especially heinous in my book, as we are the very people of all people who should know better than to ever use it with a straight face. In youth group, the word was outlawed, and in our home, it will be once our children apprehend what it means and start saying it, and then they'll say it more because they know that I hate it. But we ought to strike it from our collective vocabulary, since it should have no place in our lives, at least the idea. Over the next couple weeks, I want to look at how Christianity is the furthest thing from boring. We'll explore why Christianity is so stagnant in our culture, and perhaps stagnant in so many of our lives, along with what to do about it. We'll touch on subjects of complacency, objective evil, gratitude, novelty, and so on. As you might guess, next week we'll be focused a lot on G.K. Chesterton. I promise not to rehash material I used from last year. There's just a lot to get through. I hope that after our time of looking at the topic, you'll feel at least a bit more invigorated and less bored in action and in thought leading the Christian life. And I don't want to rehash basic elements of the faith in order to get us there. We're not going over basic truths of Sunday school. But revisiting them in a roundabout way is actually not a bad idea. I do want us to look on the story of what God has done for us with new eyes. As I talked about last year, what typically how a child sees things. Like, it's new every single time you see it, because they have terrible memories. Indeed, the Christian story, in the words of philosopher Alvin Plantinga, is not just the greatest story that ever has been told, it is the greatest story that ever could be told. Think about that for a moment. Over the years, I've taken this as an implicit challenge to come up with a cosmic narrative that resonates more profoundly with all that I know to be true about reality, and I just simply cannot conceive of a grander, more enlivening, awe-inspiring saga than that which is partially recorded for us and continues to this day. Can you? I'm not sure I can. Sure, we might quibble over a few details. There are portions of the Old Testament that it's probably difficult for us to wrap our minds around at times, sure. But the arc of the story is as sublime as they come. And we don't watch or listen to this drama of God and mankind from afar, but are rather integral participants in it. So if we all understand Christianity to be a majestic tale that's nearly too good to be true, why are so many Christians bored with their lives? How did we move from being dumbfounded by the reconciliation of God and man to an often mundane, trivial feeling day-to-day living? You've probably thought about this a little bit before, and there are some rather obvious reasons that I think we fall into this trap, and Christianity in the West falls into the trap in general. The first item would be affluence. Nothing numbs our sense of dependency, our childlike wonder, and our gratitude quite like being wealthy. And if we doubt this, I'm sure just taking away our money would probably get us to that place pretty quickly. Money often allows us to insulate ourselves from evil and the need for others made in the image of God. I mean, just think about how less dependent we are on other people, and think about how much evil, both natural and moral, we can avoid simply by our wealth. I had kidney stones a couple years ago. To get relief, all I had to do was drive 10 minutes down the road. Well, I had to wait first because Janelle was not in a real big hurry to get me to the hospital. But but then we got there, and they got me on morphine. Well, they tried this other thing that didn't really work, I think, and then morphine was that's great. But anyway, natural evil, pain, suffering, we can't mitigate it totally, but there are solutions that our wealth provides for insulating us from that, as well as from the evil of other people and being dependent on other people. Why have somebody make you something when you can just order it off of Amazon? Or why have somebody do a service for you, or why do something for yourself when you can just order somebody else to do it and pay for it? I once was told a story of a pastor from an impoverished Caribbean nation, or is it Caribbean? All right. I'll ask a Birch about that. A Brit. I will ask a Brit. Yeah, they might not want to talk with me after the first part of the sermon. I'll just settle on Caribbean. Caribbean nation, who came to speak to a group of pastors in Indiana. The pastors from Indiana remarked that they, in their congregations, often prayed for this pastor in this impoverished nation, that God would bless him and his congregation materially. The pastor from the Caribbean, in turn, said that he and his congregation often prayed for the American pastors, that the material affluence they enjoyed would not cause them to sin. So the very thing that we were praying for, or they were praying for the pastor in the Caribbean about, was the very thing that he was asking God to guard against. In Matthew 19, 23 through 24, it says, "And Jesus said to his disciples, 'Truly I say to you, it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I say to you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God.'" And there is, of course, no inherent evil in being rich, just as there's no inherent virtue in being poor. I think we'd do well to remember that as we are cast as people who are affluent, which we all are in the worldwide scope of things, are cast as evil oftentimes. There's no inherent virtue in being poor, and there's no inherent evil in being rich. But our prosperous, decadent culture does make sincere appreciation for the grand story of Christianity more difficult. Busyness also contributes to our lack of appreciation. Our overly industrious, scheduled to the second lives make love for God difficult at times. Not all the time, but at times. Reading the Bible, praying, and going to church, doing all normal Christian things, and so on, are tasks to be completed, not wonder-working activities that deepen our relationship with Christ. Being a Christian is just one of the many hats we wear, and rather than allowing the beautiful truths of the faith to undergird and and infuse everything we do, again, we treat these things as tasks. The third item would be familiarity. Many folks in this particular church and many folks in the small C Catholic church around the world have grown up hearing the story of Jesus. And that's good and fine, and I wish that I had. And our country, at least, up until a couple years ago, well, a couple decades ago probably, has been saturated with some version of the gospel and good news of Christianity, perhaps a watered-down version. But the episodes of Jonah and the whale, the flood, Adam and Eve, the virgin birth, and so forth, become a tad old hat after you've heard them 1,000 times. Familiarity does breed contempt, and contempt breeds boredom and complacency. It's easier to focus on and appreciate the new exciting things in our lives, and for many of us, Christianity is no longer new and only perhaps a little exciting. The fourth item would be chronology. We live 2,000 years after the close of the biblical canon and the events on which the New Testament reports, and this leaves us feeling distant and disaffected at times. We read of all the miraculous occurrences surrounding the life of Jesus, the prophets, the escape from Egypt, and so forth, and we feel like we've missed the boat. Though John and others have talked from this pulpit before about that perception being off and skewed, because the Bible condenses vast amounts of time, and miracles are by definition an actual occurrence very rare, we nevertheless study the scriptures and wish that they resonated more profoundly with our ordinary experiences. We don't see miracles happen on a day-to-day basis. I wish we did. Sometimes perhaps you do, but I know from experience I do not. The fifth item is skepticism. We live in a culture that loves to be unimpressed and wary of any and everything. That is the mood of the day, so to speak, and the spirit of the age is to stand back and act as if you've seen it all before and done it all before when the latest interesting story comes across your newsfeed. The arbiter of truth in America is the scientist in the white lab coat who questions whatever it is in front of him, not some Palestinian hippie from an irrelevant era long ago. 24-hour news scrolling through our televisions, our phones, and our brains relegates the details of the Bible to the back burner and makes us wonder whether any of it matters or is true in the first place. Francis Schaeffer's words about ours being a post-Christian culture are spot on. We've simply moved on from the outdated, unreliable, recycled story of Jesus, or so we sometimes feel and think. We can all think back to a time when our passion and verve for God were admirably robust. Perhaps we were less mature back then, and hopefully we were, but don't we all wish that we could recover that incandescence that we once possessed? We sing about replacing the lamp of my first love and all that sort of thing, and there is a genuine longing there to have that passion and that verve that we once had. Maybe we don't really need an overhaul in how we operate as believers, and it's not my intention to attempt that over the next couple weeks, but gentle reminders of the things we knew and appreciated being true and that we still know today in the back of our minds about the immensity of the Christian narrative need to be brought back to the forefront. We may not outright say we're bored as believers, but our conduct and habits often betray that we are. Well, where do we start? The first place I'd like to begin is with conflict and strife. Is there any time at which, if there is ever a time at which people nearly never profess boredom, although I'm sure there are instances of it, it is during a fight. I think of like those posters from the 1920s with the guys with their dukes up and and saying, bully, bully, those sort of things. We would never say you're bored during a fist fight, for instance. In all of our affluence, complacency, and security, have we forgotten that Christianity finds its genesis in conflict? Have we forgotten that, whether we like it or not, we are in a knockdown, drag-out cosmic brawl that is largely our fault? How could anyone ever be bored with that at the forefront of his or her mind? American Christians are nice. We're too nice. As we say around here, we're nicer than Jesus. This ought not to be the case. Being a Christian means being at war, and niceness is not often a sought-after trait on the battlefield. We are told in the scriptures that the world will hate us, that we will suffer, that we are to demolish false ideas, that our world is afflicted with evil of the worst kind, that we must forsake everything for Jesus, that we were once enemies of God, that there's tension all around us, that we can't serve two masters, that we are to put on the armor of God, that we must strive valiantly against sin, that we are to help spread the kingdom of God and fight tooth and nail over every inch of ground, and every inch of ground is every soul that exists. As Francis Schaeffer has written in The God Who Is There, there are four main divisions and conflicts with which every person must grapple. Man against himself, man against other men, man against the natural world, and ultimately man against God. Existence is just shot through with conflict, and no amount of ignoring it will bring about a resolution. We fight these battles because we have created the strife ourselves, and it is our duty to mend what we have broken. Each of us wakes up each morning with a tall task, to come to terms with the person in the mirror. Man warring against himself is the most basic of all division, and it is often the least forgiving. We are double-minded lovers of good and purveyors of evil at the same time. Of course, Paul's familiar words in Romans 7:15 tell the familiar tale. Quote, "For what I am doing, I do not understand, for I am not practicing what I would like to do, but I am doing the very thing that I hate." We are constantly inclined towards wickedness, but possess the image of God and are being renewed day by His Spirit. We may rightly be called righteous and malevolent in the same breath. I like a band called Switchfoot. I know many of you know them well. They have from their last album, they have a song entitled "The War Inside" that describes this turmoil well. Say, so, yeah, it's where the fight begins. Yeah, underneath the skin. Between these hopes and where we've been, every fight comes from the fight within. I am the war inside, I am the battle line, I am the rising tide, I am the war I fight. To battle against oneself is counterintuitive to a world that delights in self-indulgence and self-affirmation. Self-esteem improvement is the name of the game in our culture, and that is the only sort of improvement, as any sort of moral maturation presupposes that you are at one time behaving improperly. So to say that you can progress morally means that you were doing something wrong at one time, and that is not something that our culture would like to admit, and that we often don't. Hedonism rules our day, and if you give off any whiff of self-restraint, you will be pilloried as a puritanical prude. I had to get the alliteration in there. We know that Christianity requires bravery, and that boldness must be exercised from the moment we awake each morning. Our souls were bought at a price by Christ, and we must not let sin reign in them any longer. The great Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a man who saw the total depravity of his fellow man on full display inside a communist prison for many, many years, writes, quote, "If only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart?" End quote. For the sake of Jesus, we must be willing to brazenly put to death our old sinful self, and this requires fortitude of the highest order. Many of you will be familiar with the Milgram experiments that were conducted, I believe, as... are the psychologists in here? I'm going to screw this up. Conducted at Stanford back in the 1970s, I believe, which seemed to give a strong indication that normal, everyday people are capable of the most heinous, morally depraved actions in history. There's a book called Ordinary Men about the one of the most murderous groups of soldiers in the Third Reich in Nazi Germany, being comprised of mostly middle-class, non-Nazi-affiliated men who just, over time, worked themselves into killing machines because we're all capable of doing that. And so we lead divided lives and require courage in order to face ourselves. Not only do we combat our inward adversary, but we must be wary of the division we have with one another. Sin has alienated us from those with whom we most intimately commune, other humans made in the image of God. Even our most meaningful, loving relationships are susceptible to vaporize in the blink of an eye. There is no trust between humans such that it can't be destroyed with one careless word or deed. And I'm sure we all have a relationship or two in mind for which that is the case. Christianity is marked by the confounding and wildly difficult injunction from Jesus to love one's enemies. He tells the parable of the Good Samaritan to illustrate how scandalous loving those whom you ought to hate truly is. And we talk about all the time in youth group and in here how much the Jews hated the Samaritans. When you totally go around their area of Palestine in order to return from your pilgrimages, that's how you know you really don't want to have contact with anybody, especially when the shortest way is a straight line through Samaria. Notice that Jesus, demanding his followers to love their enemies, as we taught the kids in youth group all the time, presupposes that you have enemies, right? He doesn't qualify his words in case you're a super agreeable Christian who makes everybody happy. Even my gentle, humble, delightful wife needs to have real enemies. And so that means all of us should. This element of Christianity is awfully refreshing. Notice Jesus does not command us to sweep our conflicts under the rug or pretend that all people are basically good to one another. No, he acknowledges that there is genuine, often unresolvable separation between people, and he demands that we love anyway. Having antagonists in our lives is also never boring. People who have antagonists in their lives most often, I would think, would be soldiers, and those who have served in the military can speak to that. But American soldiers are not bemused or sort of indifferent to the fact that Al-Qaeda and ISIS want to kill them. They take having adversaries seriously and act accordingly, and we ought to as well. We have real enemies, and if you can't think of any enemies you have, that's a big problem, because you ought to have some. Seth Dreyer is fond of quoting, I believe it's Dr. Vernon Johns, and Josh probably has as well, who said, if you see a good fight, get in it. That is, if there's any just cause with real adversaries to battle, don't hesitate to get in the scrum. It simply won't do to opt out of entanglements because it makes us feel uncomfortable. I would say that if we delighted in conflict, there would be also something wrong with us. The truth and love of God compel us to be involved and compel us to have enemies because truth is more important than relationships. Have you thought about the fact that you ought to have enemies? If you don't, again, there's something wrong. Of course, as Paul tells us in Romans 12:18, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. I believe we read that recently a few weeks ago. But sometimes it is not possible to live at peace with everyone, because often it does not depend on our conduct to have interpersonal harmony with others. At other times, however, it is within our power to maintain concord with others. Being a Christian gives us license to make good enemies, but it prohibits us from making enemies because we're jackwagons. And speaking as a true jackwagon, I can tell you that I've made quite a number of unnecessary enemies in my life. The underlying assumption of so many scriptural passages is that we will create division only when we absolutely need to, in essentials unity. We don't get to treat other people like dirt because they like a different college sports team than we do or shop at a different store. Those are asinine reasons to have division and to get into fights. We need to reserve the right to make enemies for actually important things. When the onus is on us to reconcile with our brother or sister, that is, we have done something wrong, the scriptures are abundantly clear. Matthew 5:23. 24, therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, a legitimate thing against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come present your offering. One is more important than the other. Again, the fact that real reconciliation is possible means that real discord is possible between people. And it will happen. It's not just possible, it happens all the time. None of us should like or invite conflict, and I don't know that many of us do, well, when we're behaving as we wish, but we should be forthright enough to deal with it like mature Christians when it arises. Acknowledge the wrong, repent, reconcile, repeat, so forth. And God is clear that we ought to be looking for and eager for any legitimate opportunity to mend broken relationships. We should be jumping at the chance to mend broken relationships. We can't paper over conflict and pretend it doesn't exist because it usually stems from real evil. But neither can we revel in our disassociation from others. Matthew 18:21 through 22 says, "Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, 'Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to 7 times?' And Jesus answered, and you know it, 'I tell you, not 7 times, but 77 times. In other words, as many times as it takes, as many times as your brother or sister comes to you in true repentance.'" And we must do that because God has done that with us. And that is an elementary truth of the faith. Every time we sin and sincerely come to God, He offers true and genuine reconciliation, and we ought to jump and be so eager at the chance to do that with anyone we have division with. The heart of the true Christian is stalwart enough to navigate daily conflict, but tender enough to eagerly make peace the instant it's feasible. Not the instant that it's possible, because again, we want to acknowledge that conflict is real, but once it's feasible to do so. That we can be ambassadors of a message of division and a message of reconciliation each day infuses our relationships with a gravity that is difficult to measure. If we think of Christianity as being boring, I mean, we're ambassadors not only of the gospel, but we create division and unity with so many of our daily actions. That is true power. That infuses our lives with meaning and possibility. How exciting is it to be interacting with infinitely valuable human beings day in and day out who can be enemies 1 minute and friends the next? God affords us the freedom to push, to pull, to prod each other toward or away from His ends. This alone should make us jump out of bed in the morning, and I confess that I don't often, even when thinking about that, but it should be the case. That we have been given such a responsibility and privilege should be sobering. One of my favorite passages of C.S. Lewis, he writes in The Weight of Glory, quote, "It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest, most uninteresting person you can talk to," and we can all have somebody in mind when we say that it's okay, it's fine, "if you saw that person, or I'm sorry, may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, just as normal folks were in the Bible when angels showed up. Or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or the other of these destinations. It is in light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all of our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You've never talked with a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are all mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat, for it does not extend into infinity. But it is immortals with whom we joke, work with, marry, snub, and exploit, immortal horrors or everlasting splendors." And again, God has given us the wherewithal, the capability, the capacity to push, pull, and prod each other in one or the other direction. What about the conflict that man has with the rest of the created order? Whenever I think about this sort of tension, about man being in opposition to nature, I think of Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump. And perhaps you'll know the scene that I'm recalling here. I see him being in the crow's nest of he and Forrest Bubba Gump shrimping boat in the middle of a hurricane, and of course he's legless at that point from the Vietnam War, but he's sitting in the crow's nest in the middle of a hurricane out on the bayou, hurling invectives at the storm, yelling and cursing and screaming hilariously and sadly also at the storm and by proxy at God, telling them to do their worst. This is what I think of when I think of man versus nature. We know from Genesis and from just common experience that the natural world, while majestic and bespeaking a creator, is corrupted and set against us. We are told by God to be proper stewards of it, of the earth, that is, and care for it, but it is often quite inhospitable to us. The same fire that warms us burns us. The same thunderstorm that we watch with wonder can destroy our homes. The most insidious way, of course, that natural evil rears its head is in the form of human death. The disunity, pain, and uncertainty that physical death brings creates a massive problem for us. To me, as I've said before, this is the chief appeal of Christianity, and this is what makes it so exciting. I know of no bigger problem in my own life than the contemplation of death, what it means, what will happen, what are its implications, how do I address it? Christianity, in my estimation, has the most coherent, effective solution for the problem of death of any worldview I've ever examined. And it's not even close. It's not even in the same ballpark as any other. Whether you go to Hinduism and Buddhism, they're much more mystical and contending that evil is either illusory or is non-important. Whatever it is, Christianity, I feel, and you obviously do too, or you wouldn't be here probably, has the most effective solution to our chief problem, which is natural death and spiritual death. Christianity treats death as a bloodthirsty foe, and those who follow Christ can truly conquer. It is not normalized, it is not ignored, and it's not explained away by the scriptures. It is treated as an abhorrent evil that it really actually is. You will recall how Paul mocks it in light of Jesus' resurrection when he says, "Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting?" The prospect of facing death mandates courage from the Christian. How can we be bored when we might die at any given time? Since we don't know when we will die, this uncertainty serves as a healthy reminder to be living in a worthy manner here and now. It's hard for me to think of the Christian existence as mundane when our lives could be demanded from us legitimately at any minute, and we could be face to face with our Savior. Lastly, the conflict we have with God and the potential restoration we can have with Him imbues our lives with a sense of mystery and adventure. We were made for God and by God, yet we routinely act in treasonous, deplorable ways. Yet God still wants fellowship with us and devised a plan to reconcile us to Himself at a great cost to Himself. Oh, and we can begin our blissful, renewed relationship with Him right now. If this doesn't enliven our souls, I don't know that anything will. The strife from which all evil in this world stems is that of Adam and Eve in the garden, and we ratify that decision on a daily basis whenever we sin, which we do often. What task could be more substantive than that of a free-willed, sounds like something Wendell would say. free-willed child of God deciding what to do with what the gifts he has been given and the talents and capabilities and resources he or she has been given? Will we use what we have to try and sabotage the intentions and design of the maker of the universe? Or will we resolve, as C.S. Lewis puts it, to become an ingredient in the divine happiness? What could be greater than to serve the one for whom we were made? G.K. Chesterton writes, "Christianity came into the world, for a lot of trouble with W's today, world firstly in order to assert with violence that a man had not only to look inwards, but to look outwards, to behold with astonishment and enthusiasm a divine company and a divine captain. We may refuse the wishes of our captain, but the capacity to do so reveals the dignity and the magnitude of what it means to be a human. It means to be a free-willed, I can't do it. I don't know, I was even trying that time, so just done. It's going to be wheel from now on. Free-willed creature who has the capacity to either serve or not serve. There is no despair greater than that of knowing you've sinned and committed cosmic evil against the caretaker of your soul, and there is no joy greater than that of knowing you are loved by the embodiment of love and definition of love, God Himself. The reason that we're called to do battle in all four of these areas of life is that real good and real evil exist. And we can choose which we will have within ourselves, around others, concerning the natural world, and pertaining to God. And of course, if real good and real evil don't exist, then the message of the gospel won't make any sense, right? Because what use is a solution when there is no problem to begin with? I recall a story from, perhaps you guys have heard of Joshua Harris before. He wrote a book a long time ago called I Kissed Dating Goodbye. He's since written other books that I like a little bit more. But he conveys a story at one point of going into a mall to evangelize when he was much younger. And he told a girl that who was passing by him that he said, "You know, ma'am, Jesus really loves you." And she said, "I know." And she walked away upset. Now, what does that mean? Well, Joshua Harris thought it meant that we had proclaimed the love of God so much without ever actually articulating that there was a problem or a reason he ought not to love us to begin with, that the phrase, the sentiment, the message don't really make any sense anymore. The normal day of the normal Christian is suffused with moral decisions that will have ripple effects across history. How you treat your children, your spouse, your friends, your coworkers, your enemies, your leaders, your parents, yourself, etc., will quite literally reverberate down through the centuries. You've heard of the butterfly effect, for instance. A butterfly on a branch in Africa beats its wings and sets in motion a chain of events that culminate in a hurricane in the Atlantic, something to that effect. In these chain of events, seemingly insignificant actions set in motion titanic events that could never have been foreseen initially. But God has imbued us all with the capability to bring out eternally important events from the smallest of actions. Right and wrong are real. Heaven and hell are real. There is a right way and a wrong way to conduct oneself in this life. The parable of the sheep and the goats wasn't just told by Jesus for our amusement. Of course, these ideas don't sit well, very well, with the world around us. Yet it's our obligation as Christians to, if we're going to insist on a solution, to articulate the problem first. I know many of you will not share the sentiment with me, to go off on a tiny bit of a tangent before we close, but it is this pervasiveness of weighty, lofty decision-making in the life of the Christian that keeps me from enjoying most fictional works and most movies. I know those don't really tie in, but let me explain. To me, there is so much drama of the most remarkable kind in reality happening right now in your minds, in our interpersonal dynamics, in when we leave here in a bit. There is so much actual drama happening in your real life right now that to do something like sit down and read The Two Towers, while I see the value in it and won't disparage it because I'll be killed afterwards, it just doesn't seem as rich or as real or as important. Maybe I need to clarify a bit further. We often wish that our lives were more like the movies that we see, the shows that we watch, and the books that we read. And that's fine to some degree, I think. But in another sense, it's backwards. Rather than walking out of the theater or away from your television disconsolate that you don't go to Hogwarts or that you didn't actually save the world from blowing up like Kiefer Sutherland or something like, I don't even know if that's what, does he do that? Okay. All right. Be thankful that you're out of the stupid theater. Let's just be real about what the theater is. It's a place where poor facsimiles, and for you children, we get the word fax from facsimiles, which is a representation, often a poor one, of what has, nobody uses fax anymore. I know it doesn't come from that, but a poor facsimile of real life is masquerading as real life for 2.5 hours, and you're sort of sitting there with a bunch of, smelliness waiting for it to be over. Just leave. Go out. There's better things outside in the dreary December day than there are happening in there. I know that's, you're not happy about that, but there is actual evil to be combated. There are actual bad guys to fight. There are actual people to be saved. There are actual lessons to be learned, glory to be had, eternal fates to be sealed, and so forth in our daily existence. What on earth do we need Grey's Anatomy for? Your next door neighbor is wasting away into a hardened, embittered woman. Go help her. Your children are growing up to prepare for spiritual warfare. Go equip them. Your mind is languishing under the crushing weight of insipid entertainment. Go fix it. And I, again, I'm just as guilty as everybody else. Let me ring the Sunday school bell. Let me pick on Star Wars for a minute, just so we get all our bases covered and everyone hates me. The conversation you had with the ticket agent at the counter as you purchased the seats for the film was infinitely more meaningful than anything that took place on the screen. And I know you're not under the delusion that it wasn't. It's just a reminder. The bleak December day that you walked out into, or for those of you nerds who saw it in November or whenever it was that came out, I don't know when it came out. I'm just joking, but not really. That bleak December day that you walked out into after experiencing the vivid colors of whatever fictional planet was being fought over ought to have been a million times more awe-inspiring than Dumbledore's Klingon Star Cruiser that was floating around the galaxy. I thought that would get more of a laugh. But anyway. Huh? I'll get soccer next week. When I preach in 2 weeks. That'll be one. You guys can take pot shots then. So obviously some of what I'm saying is tongue-in-cheek, and there's nothing wrong with enjoying the 45th iteration of the tired Star Wars franchise, whatever you want to do. But there is something wrong if you can't see how 1 second of your typical day is infused with more grandeur and meaning than all Hollywood films or any form of entertainment, all of it put together. 1 second of your day is more meaningful than all of it. And I understand we enjoy entertainment. There's nothing wrong with that. Making a copy of something at work, tucking your kids into bed, having coffee with a friend, reading at home, coming to church, all of these are earth-shaking activities, for they involve us and they involve God, beings of infinite worth and value. There is nothing boring or pedestrian about who we are or the lives we lead. It all matters. Colossians 3:17, a verse we read a few weeks ago, conveys the point well. And whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. Even the military metaphors that we frequently use to describe the Christian existence and story don't do them justice. For military struggles, as important as they are, play second fiddle to the spiritual saga of God and man playing out in front of us. I realize that it's difficult for us to maintain a bird's eye view and proper thankfulness of many of these concepts in the daily ruck of life. We cannot keep our eyes on the immensity of the Christian proposition at all times. I get that. We shouldn't, because we'll lose sight of the things that are happening in front of us. But we should have, from time to time, a proper reminder that we're actually involved in and the immensity of what we undertake as believers. Far from leading uneventful, boring lives, Christians are the very people who ought to realize how momentous their existence is. It may not feel like it at times, it may not feel like it a lot of the time, but that doesn't change who we are in God's eyes. To recognize this is not to bask in self-importance, but to appreciate the implications of Jesus' charge to us and design for us. The task he has given us is beset by real danger, real conflict, real intrigue, redemption, and all the rest that ennobles our lives. Next week, we'll talk about thankfulness, another pillar of the Christian existence that helps us grasp the gift, opportunity, novelty, and wonder that life is. And I promise it will not include pot shots at Star Wars and whatever other series of movies that are popular. As usual, as I said, we'll have help from G.K. Chesterton to explore this topic. So if the children would come in, the musicians come forward, we'll continue in musical worship together.